This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Doe Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
The first question this week is from Margaret Feaster. She asks, if I fall from high in the atmosphere where the gravity of the whole Earth is pulling me down, I would accelerate to high speed. So as I go faster and faster, would my mass increase? Then, if I proceeded to fall to the centre of the Earth through a handy straight tunnel, would I zoom past the centre, then fall back again, and eventually slow down to a stop at the centre, and therefore lose the mass I would have gained while speeding? I guess a simpler question would be, does a pendulum have a greater mass while it is swinging than when it stops at the bottom of its path?
It's a good question, isn't it? And the simple answer is yes. And it's all down to Einstein's special theory of relativity. And that basically tells us that the mass of a moving object is increased. And it's increased by a factor called the Lorentz factor. So we usually write it with a Greek letter gamma. And it's actually equal to, the formula for it, it's equal to 1 over the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared, where v is the velocity or the speed of the object, c is the speed of light. So it's all about how fast you're going relative to the speed of light. And so in that formula, if you can remember that formula, if you put v equals 0, so the object's not moving, you put that into that formula, that this gamma factor, this Lorentz factor, comes out to 1. So that means that your mass is basically just your rest mass. You multiply it by this factor of 1, it doesn't change it. But as soon as you start moving and V gets faster and faster, then you start multiplying it by a bigger and bigger number. This gamma factor gets bigger and bigger. And it sort of rises slowly at first, but then really rapidly ramps up towards the end until it reaches the sort of ultimate limit, which is the speed of light, at which point if you plug V equals C into that formula, you'd end up with a gamma factor of infinity, actually. So it rises rapidly towards the end. Now, so in that sense, the answer is yes. As she falls in the atmosphere, as you speed up, your mass would increase. But it's actually only an infinitesimally small amount, a very tiny amount. I worked out if you were traveling in a passenger jet, so if you go on a normal sort of Boeing 747 or something, they travel at about 250 meters a second. So in that formula, which is pretty fast, but in that formula, what matters is V over C. So you have to compare that speed of 250 meters per second to the speed of light, which is 300 million meters per second. 3 × 10⁸ meters per second.
It's a lot bigger than...
So that's a lot bigger than even 250 meters per second. So that would have almost no effect. I mean, you can accelerate particles to high fractions of the speed of light. So something like the Large Hadron Collider does it. And so we do see this effect. And if you get to something like, I mean, for example, if you take an electron or something, accelerate it through a potential difference, you can get it to maybe 99% of the speed of light, then actually its mass goes up by a factor of 7.
A factor of 7?
Yeah, so it's 7 times heavier if it's moving at 99% of the speed of light. But you do have to get up to those high velocities. So in her, in the example that we were just given of falling towards the Earth and then falling through the middle of the Earth, which is a neat trick. As everybody knows, actually, the way to the middle of the Earth is through a volcano in Iceland. Did you know that?
No.
You need to read Jules Verne.
Oh.
So I was there recently, actually. Snæfellsjökull, it's called, the volcano. So that's where in Jules Verne's Journey to the Centre of the Earth, they go through that hole. And it's not a straight tunnel either. But never mind. If we imagine this straight tunnel that goes down through the middle of the Earth, then, yeah, you'd sort of accelerate faster and faster down as you fell down that centre, down that tunnel, I should say. And, in fact, if you imagine this bizarre situation with this tunnel, it was a vacuum, and you had some breathing apparatus, I guess, and the Earth wasn't spinning around as well. If you sort of jumped off the edge and fell down the tunnel, then actually all things being equal, you'd whiz through the middle of the Earth, right through the centre of the Earth, centre point of the Earth.
All the way through.
All the way through. 42 minutes later, you'd pass through the middle. You'd be travelling at a speed of almost 18,000 miles an hour. But then you would sort of head out the other way, and at that point then the gravity of the Earth is sort of slowing you down. So you gradually slow down, and as I say, all things being equal, you'd just pop up again on the other side, and hopefully someone would grab you, because otherwise you'd go straight back down again and all the way back through, and you'd sort of oscillate backwards and forwards if there was no air resistance. Obviously a bit of air resistance, you'd eventually settle to the middle of the Earth. But even at that speed of 18,000 miles an hour, which is very fast, obviously, it's nearly 8 kilometres a second, even then that ratio of speed, velocity that you're travelling at compared to the speed of light is only 0.003%. So
still
in that,
pretty tiny.
Yeah, so in that formula, that Lorentz factor, that gamma factor is still basically one, pretty much one. So even when even you imagine that, you're not going to travel fast enough to increase your mass perceptibly.
So you'd have to be travelling really, really quickly before you'd notice anything.
Absolutely. And we do see that. Well, we tend to see it with subatomic particles, which are, easier to accelerate effectively with the sort of energies we have available.
Our second question comes from Stanley Fertig, who asks, how does a light sail work? If photons have no mass, then how can they impart momentum onto an object they hit? Or is the latter's momentum the result of a heating effect?
Yeah. So first of all, we should probably say what a light sail is, first of all. Mm-hmm. So this is this idea that you put a, it effectively works like a boat's sail, except you put this sort of big object in space, this big sail, probably not made of cloth, but something else. And then effectively the light of the sun, the radiation from the sun, the photons from the sun, so hit this sail. And as he says, the idea is that as they hit it, they basically push the sail, and that accelerates the spaceship. So you use it just like a boat, you would use a sail with the wind. But for that to work, these photons have to sort of, in the collision, the photon has to transfer some momentum to the sail, to the spacecraft, for it to accelerate it. And the problem, the thing that Stanley's worried about, is the fact that photons have no mass. And what he's thinking about is this sort of classical expression for momentum, which is mass times velocity. So for momentum, we usually give it a symbol P, is equal to mv, mass times velocity. And obviously, if you had a mass of zero, your momentum would be zero, and then that mechanism couldn't work. And in fact, just sort of linking this with the last question, actually, the solution is special relativity. Because in special relativity, that formula, P equals mv, is modified. So that m, that mass, is now not the rest mass, it's the relativistic mass. So that's multiplied by this factor gamma again, so the same Lorentz factor.
So the relativistic mass is just the mass multiplied by the rest factor.
Exactly, it's the rest mass multiplied by the Lorentz factor multiplied by gamma. So you've basically got this sort of formula that says that relativistic momentum is gamma m naught v, where m naught would be the rest mass. You've also got a relativistic energy, which is gamma m naught c squared. So you'll have heard of E equals mc squared.
Mm-hmm.
So what the m in that case for a moving object would be this gamma m naught. It's gamma times the rest mass m naught. So actually, if you sort of allow for that correction to standard classical sort of physics, then if you have a particle that's got no mass, so its mass is zero, but it's traveling at a speed, a typical sort of speed that we might see around us, like the supersonic aircraft or something along those lines, then in those formulae, you plug in you work out a gamma factor, like we were just doing, but you plug in a mass of zero, a rest mass of zero, and you get an answer of zero. So the momentum would be zero and the energy would be zero,
mm-hmm.
Right? So that would be sort of what he's saying. But the difference is, if you've got a particle with zero mass, but whose speed is actually equal to the speed of light, so if V equals C, which is what is true for a photon, which is what we're talking about here, then you use those formulae, you actually end up with an energy which is given by zero divided by zero, and you get momentum that's zero divided by zero in those formulae.
Okay.
Now that's a sort of problem mathematically, because you think, well, what's the answer to zero divided by zero? Is it because you're dividing the same two numbers together, you get the answer one, or is it because you're dividing by zero, you get the answer infinity? So in fact, it's undefined. So in principle, you could end up with any energy or momentum. Just to maybe put some more flesh on that, really, if you take those two formulae for relativistic momentum, P equals gamma mv and E equals gamma m naught c squared, and you combine them together, you get this classical formula in relativity, which is a relationship between energy and momentum, which is E squared equals P squared C squared plus M naught squared C to the fourth.
Allowing you to have a...
Yeah, so that's basically relating energy to momentum and to rest mass. And so you can take that formula, and if you can sort of picture it in your head, E squared is the energy, is equal to P squared C squared, P is the momentum, plus m naught squared c to the 4, m naught's the rest mass. So if you put m naught equals 0, you end up with e squared equals p squared c squared, or e equals pc. And that relates energy to momentum in relativity. And for a photon does have energy. Its energy is given by, actually given by the Planck constant h times its frequency, or so hf or hc over lambda in the case of a wavelength lambda. And so you can actually find an expression for the momentum of a photon, which is the energy divided by c, p equals e over c. So photons, massless objects, travelling at the speed of light, do indeed have a momentum. So that's okay. And actually, it was funny because it made me, it stimulated me to go and look up an example of a solar sail. Because I was thinking, okay, so theoretically they are possible, right? Mm-hmm. Where are we with that? And I hadn't heard of this, but there's a Japanese spacecraft called Icaros, Icaros, which okay. I guess there was a play on Icarus.
I assume so.
So it's sort of the person that flew too close to the sun. So this stands for Icaros, in this case, stands for Interplanetary Kite Craft Accelerated by Radiation of the Sun, Icaros. And that was actually launched in 2010. Headed towards the sun and actually passed by Venus. And that's now apparently the first spacecraft to successfully demonstrate this solar sail technology. It's in the Guinness Book of Records as the world's first solar sail spacecraft between planets. And it had a solar sail that was basically 14 metres by 14 metres. Imagine that. It's fairly large.
How big was the craft itself?
I'm not sure. I mean, it would have been, presumably, it's, you know, as you say, you'd have to make it as light as possible. In fact, I think, if I remember rightly from reading up about this, I think the cameras were very tiny that it had on it that they were using. So probably you'd try and make this thing weigh as little as possible for it to, you know, get a significant acceleration. So it would have been small, I think. I'm not exactly sure of the answer to that. But the weird thing about that, I mean, it's an interesting thing, actually, is not only was it pushed by the solar wind, this radiation pressure, they also stuck some solar cells on the solar sail, so that the photons was generating energy.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. So it's basically a double whammy. So it was able to power its own propulsion system from some of the photons hitting the sail, as well as using the momentum of the photons hitting the sail.
That's incredibly efficient.
No, it's a neat trick. And the plan is to launch a bigger one. Mm-hmm. 50 metres or so across or something like that, to head to Jupiter later in the decade.
Oh, brilliant. And we'll put some links to that on the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Our third question comes from Rob Bowman, who says, for a lot of the work that radio astronomers do, you use a very narrow beam width to look at a tiny area of the sky. So why is electromagnetic interference from, for example, mobile phones a problem?
Yeah, sensible point, actually. And just to sort of explain what he's talking about there, he's talking about this narrow beam width. What that means is when you've got a sort of big dish telescope and you point it in a particular direction, it's effectively only seeing, we talk about it, only seeing a very small spot on the sky. And so he's effectively saying, okay, we've got this radio telescope, it's pointed over there somewhere. It's only looking in that direction. Why would you worry about a mobile phone off on the ground somewhere way off to the side? You know, it wouldn't even be pointing in the right direction, so it wouldn't pick it up, it wouldn't cause interference. Well, I mean, you know, in general terms, that's true. They do have these sort of these beams, and the width of the beam, we sort of think about how broad this beam is when a telescope's looking in a particular direction. It depends on the wavelength you're using and the diameter of the telescope. And the width is actually in measured in angular units of radians. It's wavelength divided by diameter. So to give an example, if we pick the Lovell telescope at Jodrell, which has a diameter of about 76 metres, and we say we were working using it at a wavelength of 21 centimetres, which is a common wavelength for us to use, that calculate that angle from lambda over d, you get about 10 arc minutes. So an arc minute is 1/60th of a degree. So 10 arc minutes is about a third the width of the full moon. So if you imagine the Lovell telescope looking up into the sky, the radio waves, it's sort of picking up from a patch on the sky about a third the size of the full moon. Now, actually, that means its view is blurred to that level.
So it doesn't see anything that's much
smaller than that. Exactly. So that's, you know, a limitation of a single telescope. And that's why we have these big interferometer arrays where we extend them over many kilometres, 200 kilometres in the case of E. Merlin. That allows us to, you know, get a synthesizer, much smaller beam, and look at finer detail in things on the sky. So yeah, you can, even so, you know, for an astronomer, a third the size of the full moon's pretty blurry and that beam's quite wide. But it still would be the case. You imagine it looking up there, you know, you think, well, if it's all coming from that direction, where does the mobile phone matter? Well, there's a couple of things really. And one is that it's not entirely true that it's all from that single beam in that direction. There's things that radio astronomers call side lobes.
Side lobes?
Side lobes, yes. And what they are, I don't know whether, if you've seen, I don't know if anybody's seen, so if some Hubble Space Telescope images, for example, of bright stars, what you see is this sort of spot of the star itself in the middle, but then around it, you might just be able to see for the brightest stars, you see these sort of circular, these concentric ripples, effectively rings of light, concentric ripples around this central bright spot. So that's basically a diffraction pattern of a point. The star's effectively a point source on the sky. And as the, you know, it's basically a fundamental limitation of collecting the light in an aperture, whether it's a big radio telescope or it's the Hubble Space Telescope mirror, you get this diffraction pattern. So what that means is for this radio telescope, you've got this central beam, which is the 10 out minute wide spot at the center. But then surrounding it, there are these sort of concentric rings where you would still pick up radio waves coming from that circle around it, and then from another circle around that farther out, and so on.
So it has like its main collecting area, and then it sort of gets contaminated, for want
exactly.
of a better word.
Yeah. So in fact, in terms of doing radio astronomy on the sky, if you were looking at a really faint object in a particular point on the sky, you point your telescope at that object. If you had a really bright object off to one side somewhere that happened to be sitting on one of these side lobes, one of these ripples, what it means is you see radio waves from that as well that mix into the faint stuff you're trying to detect in your main beam. So that's called, you know, that's a confusing effect where you get those sorts of things coming in through the side lobes. Now, luckily, the side lobes are much weaker than the main beam. So they're much, so you don't, you know, you'd have to have a very strong source to detect it through the side lobe. But for something like a mobile phones are significantly brighter than the astronomical sources we're looking at. So they're really strong, bright sources. So they can come in through the side lobes, so off to one side of the telescope, of the direction we're pointing in. Plus, if you imagine sort of looking up at the Lovell telescope, pointing at an angle, you can actually see the focus box where the receiver is. You can see the receiver itself depending on the angle. So if you've got a mobile phone sitting there, the mobile phone signal can see straight into the receiver. So it doesn't have to reflect off the dish and be collected at the focus in the normal way, which is all this beam and side lobe business. It can just go straight in and be detected directly, or reflect off part of the structure and into the thing. So it's the very fact that they're bright that means that it still does cause a problem.
So if you're ever going to visit any of the radio telescopes, keep your phone off. And if you have any astronomical questions, then feel free to send them in via all the usual routes.